fancy new toaster oven. Owen's mother collected cosmos and catmint, seagrass and hydrangeas, and made charming, casual arrangements that she stuck in empty jam jars that still wore the remnants of their labels, and rode an elderly 3-speed Schwinn with balding tires and an ancient wicker picnic basket bungee-corded to the rear rack. Sarah's mom hired florists and drove a minivan. At Owen's house, they kept the windows open, the patchy screens admitting flies and mosquitoes to be cursed at or slapped away. At Sarah's house, her mother could control the temperature with the touch of a button and used a remote control to raise or lower the blinds. Owen's people would swim in the pond or the ocean in the cool morning hours, nap during the heat of the day, and eat and drink late into the night by the glow of the bonfires they light on the beach. Members of her family bent the climate to their will, shutting out the sounds of the wind and the sea with double-paned glass, installing a swimming pool with its bright chlorinated water instead of being content with the bay or the ponds. Now here was Owen telling her that the choices she'd found so charming were not quirks or idiosyncrasies, but plain old poverty. It was unsettling. She felt terrible for assuming and for romanticizing, a little uneasy about what else she'd missed or gotten wrong, and she still didn't understand how Owen had vanished so completely, like he'd erased himself from her life and somehow managed to take his house with him. "So Sass and Anders got divorced and the camp got sold," she said. "You could have told me that's what was happening. Why didn't you call me or email me? Even if we weren't still going out, we could have been friends." "You wouldn't have wanted to hear from me." "Well, maybe not right away, after being dumped by email, but eventually." He shook his head. In a soft, toneless voice, he said, "You wouldn't have wanted to hear from me because I lied to you." Sarah just looked at him as Owen said, "I wasn't at Duke. I didn't get in." Sarah stared across the table, shocked into silence. Over the summer they'd spent together, Owen had spoken in elaborate detail about the campus, about the lacrosse team's preseason and its coach. He told her the name of his dorm and the name of his suite mates and teammates, the classes he was going to take, and how he was already planning to sleep outdoors in a tent in Kayville, named in honor of Duke's famous basketball coach, in hopes of getting tickets to the games. Sarah shook her head. "I don't understand." Owen sighed, the memory of old disappointment darkening his features. "Believe me, neither did I at the time. My guidance counselor said I was a sure thing."
"And you are a great lacrosse player."
Owen made a scoffing noise. "Good, not great. Definitely not as good as I led you to believe."
"Weren't you all state?"
"In Rhode Island," he said, shamefaced. "It's not a very big state."
She licked her lips and rubbed her hands against her thighs. "I don't know what to say. So it wasn't that you'd met some other girl?"
He shook his head. "All summer long, every day, I'd wake up and think, today I'm going to tell her the truth. But I couldn't." He shook his head. "You were this perfect, shining thing. You were so talented, and you were going to be a famous pianist."
"And you can see how well that turned out," Sarah said, and hoped she sounded wry, not bitter.
Hoping, too, that her face didn't show how the words "perfect, shining thing" were ringing through her, making her feel trembly and flushed.
"I was embarrassed," Owen said. "I felt like a failure, and a fraud, and a liar. Probably because I was a liar. But more than that, I didn't want you thinking..."
He paused, tilting his head toward the ceiling again. "I wanted you to think I was what I pretended to be, a rich, preppy kid on his way to play lacrosse at the Harvard of the South. That's who I wanted to be."
He lowered his head and looked at her. "Because that's the boy you were in love with."
"No," Sarah said. She reached across the table and touched his hand.
I was in love with you. She felt herself blush at the words, but how could she not have said them? She'd loved Owen the way she'd never loved any boy or man. There was nothing as pure or as passionate as that kind of first love. And she thought, nothing as devastating as that first breakup. Owen smoothed his cropped hair with both hands. In my family, lying was a way of life. I was just keeping up the family tradition. Where did you go? Sarah asked. You did go to college somewhere, right? University of Vermont, said Owen, and gave her a crooked smile. I did a lot of skiing. It wasn't so bad. After Sass sold the camp, there was some more money. Then, after she got married again and moved out of Westport, there was even more. Sarah said nothing. She was remembering how she'd felt the summer after her freshman year, swimming across the pond hoping to see Owen, and instead of his house seeing nothing but a hole in the ground. How it had felt hearing that automated voice in her ear, telling her there was no listing for any Lassiters anywhere. The house was a teardown, but the land itself was worth a good bit of money. It got us back on our feet. He looked up, his brilliant blue eyes finding her gaze. But I couldn't tell you what was really going on, and my mom... He paused. Sarah waited, realizing that this was the first time Owen had called Sass his mom. The Cape was a huge part of her identity. She'd gone there as a kid, and it meant a lot that she'd been the one to inherit the place from her grandparents. It killed her having to sell it. He was quiet for a minute, smoothing the shreds of his napkin with one long-fingered hand. She had kind of a breakdown that year, after she and Anders split. I think losing the camp, losing her place, was worse than losing her husband. He gave Sarah his rueful smile again. It's hard to play it off like you're part of the landed gentry when you don't have any land. Sarah shook her head, still feeling unsettled and bewildered. I can't believe I didn't know. You weren't supposed to know. Owen's voice was patient. That was the whole point. No one was supposed to know. He steepled his hands on the table. And none of it excuses blowing you off the way I did. Sarah nodded. She could still picture the email, the sting of that handful of words that she still knew by heart. I've met someone here, and I want to be with her. I'm sorry, but it's for the best. We should both be free. She could also remember her pulse beating hard in her throat as she'd swam across the pond to the opposite shore where the camp had been and found no house at all. There'd been a bulldozer where the boathouse had stood, and a crane, a bunch of workmen standing around a hole in the ground, smoking cigarettes and tossing their butts into the dirt. Sarah had been gaping when one of the men had noticed her. "You lost, sweetheart?" he'd asked, his expression just short of a leer. "This is private property." Private property, Sarah thought, remembering the first time she'd heard Owen Lassiter's voice. Without saying a word, she had turned around and swum back the way she'd come. Owen looked down. "I was ashamed. I didn't want you knowing the truth about me, about us, about any of it. You know that it wouldn't have made a difference. I didn't..." She took a sip of water and patted her lips dry. "I didn't care about money or your family. I cared about you. But you didn't know who I was, not really." He lifted his gaze to meet hers. Up close, she could see faint wrinkles around his eyes, a few strands of gray in his eyebrows. But his eyes were still that brilliant, aching blue of a perfect summer day. "And I'm sorry. You deserved the truth. I just wish..." He paused, drumming his fingers on the table. Sarah felt her mouth go dry. She was barely breathing, fingers twisting in her lap, heart fluttering, knowing what was coming. "I wish we'd had a real chance," he said. "Because I've never been as happy with anyone as I was with you that summer." She looked across the table at the first boy she'd ever loved, saying nothing, not trusting herself to speak. "Are you happy?" he asked gently. I thought about you so much after we..." His voice trailed off and he gave a wry smile. "Well, after I dumped you. I hated that I'd hurt you, and I'd always hoped that you were happy." "Am I?" Sarah asked herself. "Not lately." And here was Owen, looking at her like she was the only woman in the world. Ever since she'd texted him, no, Sarah thought, ever since she'd seen him, she'd been deciding what would happen next, how far she'd let herself go. She'd spent almost 15 years with Eli and had never once considered cheating. She'd never even been seriously tempted. And Owen was so handsome, and it had been so long, and he was looking at her with an intensity that made her feel like she was melting, like she'd spill right out of her seat. "Do you have any plans right now?" she asked him. He met her eyes and shook his head. "Come with me," she said, and Owen got immediately to his feet without asking where they were going, like he'd follow anywhere she led. They were mostly quiet as they walked through Central Park to her studio. Sarah unlocked the front door and led him up the stairs, aware of his closeness. She opened the door to her place, now furnished, her single bed against one wall, her piano against the other, the two windows overlooking the street, a bouquet of white hydrangeas on the coffee table. Owen looked around and nodded like he was confirming something he already knew. "This is exactly the kind of place where I imagined you living." "It is?" she asked, thinking how different the studio was from the brownstone, which was bright and warm and colorful, full of furniture and art and toys and books and people. Here the walls were painted white. There was just a stack of sheet music on the piano's lid, a single framed poster from the Spoleto Festival on the wall, the white flowers on the kitchen's tiny counter, and the white down comforter on the bed. "Like an artist's garret, just you and your music." He gave her another knee-wobbling smile, then nodded at the piano. "Will you play for me?" "Oh, I don't..." "Please?" She'd only played for Owen once in their time together, that first night he'd come for dinner. She'd been reluctant. Part of her didn't want him to think she was showing off, and another part couldn't wait to dazzle him. "Play one of your recital pieces," her mother had called from the kitchen, and Sam, lounging on the couch, had popped his head up to say, "She's really good." She sat at the keyboard, played a few scales to warm up her fingers, and decided on one of the first recital pieces she'd ever learned, something that even a non-classical music lover would appreciate. The first movement of Beethoven's Opus 79 in G major, the Cuckoo Sonata, so-called because it imitated the call and repeat of a songbird. It was bright and playful and had some showy moments where her left hand would cross over her right. Sarah had adjusted the bench, then her posture, then struck the first three chords. By the third or fourth measure, she'd closed her eyes, and by the time she reached the first repeat, the room and her family and her boyfriend had all ceased to matter. The room had disappeared, and it was, as ever, just Sarah and the music, Sarah and the song. When the final note had died away, she'd opened her eyes. Her parents stood together, her dad with his arm around her mom's waist, both of them beaming at her. Sam applauded. Owen had looked stunned. "Oh my God," he'd blurted. Sam had sat up. "Told ya," he'd said. Sarah had brushed off their compliments, feeling proud and shy. Later on the beach, Owen had kissed her with something like reverence and said, "You never told me you were that good." In her studio, with the sounds of the city coming through the windows, Owen took her hand and led her to the piano. "Please," he said, "I've waited so long to hear you play again." Sarah struck the first notes of the Moonlight Sonata, knowing that she was lost. She might have been able to resist Owen's good looks and charm. She could have made herself immune to flattery or the way hearing someone else's confession could soften you. But the way he looked at her, that combination of tenderness and awe, like she was special and talented, some rare and beautiful creature he couldn't believe he was allowed to touch, that Sarah could not withstand. She played him pieces she thought he would know, a Brahms lullaby, a Bach concerto, and Mozart's Piano Sonata 16, which made him smile. This time, instead of losing herself in the music, she found herself aware of Owen, his presence, his warmth, his eyes on her. When she finished, she pushed back the bench and got to her feet. Owen was standing behind her with that same look of amazement on his face. A look that said, "You are the most incredible thing. You astonish me." When he opened his arms, Sarah did not hesitate. She walked into his embrace, fitting herself against him like a puzzle piece into its space, like a key into a lock, like every cliche about long-lost lovers who are meant to be together. She was the one to put her hand on his neck and draw his lips down to hers. She was the one who unbuttoned his shirt, then led him toward her single bed. "I deserve this," Sarah told herself, remembering all the times Eli had ignored her or looked right through her. All the times he'd come slap-slapping down the hall in his infernal flip-flops, or tried to give away the thing she loved. "Kiss me," she whispered, pulling him close. Then his arms were around her, his mouth on hers again. Sarah closed her eyes, savoring the sensations that threatened to overwhelm her. The feeling of adult Owen superimposed over Owen at 18. Then Owen's face had been boyishly smooth. Now Owen had stubble that rasped her cheeks. Then Owen had been more passionate than skilled, enthusiastic with his tongue and his hands. Now Owen was a much more skilled kisser. Much more skilled at everything, Sarah thought as he unhooked her bra one-handed and eased his other hand up her skirt. But then, when he touched her between her legs for the first time, he gave a soft groan, just as then Owen had done all those years ago. He'd sounded like she was a marvel, like she imagined the old explorers had sounded when they'd finally sighted land. Now Owen hummed a pleased sound against her neck as he slipped his fingers inside of her, then pulled them out, stroking delicately along the edges of her most private place. And it was so good that Sarah gasped out loud. She reached for his belt, then his zipper. Part of her wanted to show him that she too had grown up, that she, like him, had learned things, but part of her, most of her, just wanted him naked and inside her. Owen scooped her up and set her gently on the bed, then lay down beside her. They kissed and kissed, and Sarah let her hands explore the thicker tangle of hair on his chest, the play of muscles beneath the warm skin of his flanks, the strong length of his legs. Finally, she urged him onto his back. She gripped his erection, giving it a single slow stroke, twisting her hand as she went, making him gasp before she straddled him, settling her knees on each side of his hips. In the dimness of the room, his eyes were open wide, his pupils large and dark, taking her in. "Wait," he said hoarsely, just before she slid down, drawing him inside of her. "Do I need—" She shook her head. She'd had her tubes tied after Miles. Two boys plus Ruby was all she'd ever want, she thought. Now a part of her cried out for the years they hadn't had, for the babies they'd never make. She slid down, taking him inside of her, and regret and comparison and every other conscious thought left her mind, until all that was left were bodies, fitted together in the gathering twilight. When it was over, Owen fell asleep, curled against her, one leg slung over hers, Sarah lay on her back, looking up at the ceiling, hearing the day winding down. She could hear more of the traffic outside her window than she could in Park Slope. A neighbor's voice in the hallway, a burst of laughter from the sidewalk below. Sarah stared up into the shadows, hearing Owen's voice. "This is exactly the kind of place where I imagined you living." This was a life she could have had. Maybe the life she should have had instead of what she'd had at 25. As a new wife and the step-parent of an 8-year-old. A studio room instead of a brownstone. A home with no space for anything but her piano. A life with no room for anything but her music. A half-sized refrigerator. A two-burner stove. Less a home than a touchdown pad. A place to land between engagements in Leipzig and Paris and London. Or, she supposed, between cruises on the ship where she'd play in the cocktail lounge. No children to distract her, no day job to eat up her time. Nothing but music and the man who loved her. The comfort of his body, the balm of his attention. If she and Owen had stayed together, she could have had that life. More likely, Sarah thought, she would have spent her 20s at parties and happy hours and on first dates, having her heart broken, feeling increasingly frantic as the finish line loomed. So she'd chosen Eli, jumping into marriage and a ready-made family, fast-forwarding right through her 20s. Sometimes it had felt like she'd walked into a movie that had already begun. While her friends were trying to get pregnant, were enduring miscarriages or struggling with babies, she was dealing with a bratty 8-year-old. While they'd been applying to kindergartens, she'd been pregnant and planning a bat mitzvah. She hadn't been unhappy, but an older husband and a stepdaughter had meant she was always a little out of step with her peers. Did that mean she'd chosen incorrectly? Were there lessons she should have been learning, experiences she should have been having in those first years she'd spent as Eli's wife and Ruby's stepmother? Could she wish her boys away, or wish she'd never known Ruby, never made it through all of Ruby's scorn and rejection to the reward on the other side? In the near dark, with Owen breathing steadily beside her, no answer came. Sarah lay awake, thinking, until it was 7 o'clock, and she knew she'd need to either text home with some excuse or leave immediately. She was trying to edge herself out of the bed when Owen sighed, pulling her close, kissing her neck. "What are you thinking?" he asked. Sarah shook her head, knowing that she had too many thoughts to sort through, and certainly too many to say out loud. The only thing she knew for sure was that she wasn't sorry. Maybe later there'd be guilt and regret, but for now, there was only the delicious high of new love, or, she supposed, new old love, the surging chemicals that made her feel like she'd never need to eat or sleep again. "When can I see you?" Owen asked. Sarah got out of bed and began gathering her things, skirt and underwear, bra and blouse and shoes. She started to get dressed, reassembling herself as a wife and a mother. "I'm going to be busy for the next few weeks. My stepdaughter's getting married, on the Cape, as it happens." "Congratulations," Owen said. "When do you leave?"
3 weeks, she said. "The wedding's 4th of July weekend."
"Huh. Really? I'll be on the Cape then." She turned around to look at him. He held his hands open, grinning. "It's still my favorite place in the world. I go for 2 weeks every summer. I stay at the same Airbnb in Wellfleet. It's near where the camp used to be." He got up, crossed the room, embraced her. "You don't have to see me," he said. "But I'll be there if you decide that you want to." Dismayed, Sarah shook her head. "It's Ruby's wedding," she said. "I can't. I won't ruin anything." "Of course not." His tone was indulgent, and his fingers were tracing patterns on her back and her bottom. "I'm just saying maybe you get to slip away for an hour or two. I could make a picnic. We could go for a swim. You'll need a break from everything, right?"
Even as she shook her head, Sarah was imagining it, being with Owen in the water again, swimming across the pond, his blue eyes fringed with dark, wet lashes. How it had felt to kiss him there, their bodies cool, their lips warm. "Maybe," she whispered. Owen kissed her, then pressed his finger against her lips, like he was fixing her conditional assent in place. "I'll keep my phone on. I'll be waiting." Part 3. Met by Moonlight. And so here they were, thought the house. The mother and her children and their children. Other adults, some of them strangers, some familiar. One who'd been a girl, now all grown up. How good it felt to be full again, she thought. How good to welcome people, to hold them, to do what she'd been built to do. How good it was to feel little feet trotting up and down her stairs. How good to hear them splashing in the pool, the hum of conversation, the smells of good things to eat. "You can't leave me," she thought to the woman, whose step had gotten slower, who'd started crying in the shower and alone in her bed at night, whose scent now included a new unsettling note that the house recognized with sorrow. "You can't go yet. We have work still to do. We have to fix this. We have to fix them. You need me, and I need you. You need this, all of the people you love around you, and you need me for it to happen. Don't leave," the house pleaded in words no one could hear. And when the woman didn't answer, she knew it was time to act. Wednesday. Sam. Sam and Connor left Los Angeles early on a Wednesday morning and landed in Boston at just after 1 o'clock, which became just after 4 o'clock, a change that confused and delighted Connor. "But how did we lose 3 hours?" he asked, his voice plaintive. "Where did they go?" Collecting their luggage and their rental car went smoothly, and traffic was light. "If this were a Saturday," Sam said, as they crossed the Bourne Bridge, "we'd be sitting here for hours." They stopped for lunch in Chatham. Connor had fish and chips, and Sam enjoyed his first oysters of the summer. By 8 o'clock, they were pulling into the driveway of the Levy-Weinberg home, and Veronica was waving from the second-floor deck, backlit by the setting sun. "Hi, Mom," said Sam, bounding up the stairs to kiss her, hoping he didn't look as startled as he felt by her appearance. He hadn't seen his mother in person since his dad's funeral, before COVID and the lockdowns, and in the intervening months she seemed to have sped through the remainder of late middle age and gone straight to old. Her skin had new wrinkles, her hair was as fine as dandelion fluff, and she moved with the slow, careful gait of an invalid. As he walked up the stairs behind Connor, he wondered what he'd missed and how it had been for her, alone on the Outer Cape, which emptied out from October to May. Had she been sick? Had she been lonely? Was he a terrible son because he hadn't come to visit? Veronica bent down to Connor's eye level to greet him. "Hi, Connor. I'm Sam's mom. We've met before, but you might not remember." Connor was prepared. He was the kind of child who always liked to know what he'd be doing and where and for how long and with whom, and so Sam always let him know the schedule. During the last half hour of the car ride, Sam had briefed him on the wedding guests and how all of them were connected. "You were there when Sam and my mom got married, right?" he asked Veronica. "I remember, but I was a little kid then," Connor said, with all the scorn an 8-year-old can muster for his 5-year-old self. Sam saw his mother hide a smile when Connor extended his hand for a shake and gravely shake it. Connor looked up at Sam and said, "Can we go in the pool now?" Sam convinced him to have dinner first. Veronica had hot dogs and sausages waiting, They ate on the picnic table on the deck and had chunks of watermelon for dessert. Veronica told Sam that his sister was on her way. Sarah decided to bring Ruby up tonight, and Eli and the boys will come tomorrow. Sam agreed to let Connor have a quick swim before bedtime. "I'm not even tired," Connor said, his words immediately belied by an enormous yawn. "Well, it's only dinner time in California," Ronnie said, which launched another conversation about time zones. "One quick swim, then bed by 9, Sam said. 9:30? 9:15. Sam dug Connor's bathing suit out of their bags and was handing his stepson a towel when Sarah and Ruby pulled up the driveway. Sarah got out of the car, then opened the back door so that Lord Farquaad could escape. The dog shook himself off, strutted across the driveway on his stumpy legs, and peed disdainfully on a rose bush before making his way up to the pool. Sarah opened the trunk and handed Ruby a garment bag, which she carefully draped over her arms. Her wedding dress, Sam figured. "Can I help?" he called.
"No, we've got it," his sister called back. "We'll be right up."
Sam watched as Ruby ceremoniously carried her dress up the stairs and into the guest house, with Sarah behind her, pulling a wheeled suitcase with a duffel bag over her arm. A moment later, everyone was on the pool deck, exchanging hugs and greetings. "Where's the lucky guy?" Sam asked.
"He'll be up tomorrow," Ruby said.
"His mom and his aunt are flying into Boston, and he's going to rent a car and drive them up."
"I can't wait to meet him," said Sam.
Ruby gave him a distracted smile and said, "I've got to make some calls."
"Watch this," Ronnie called.
She flicked on the pool light and smiled at Connor's approval when the water lit up, brilliantly turquoise.
"I love Cape Cod,"
Connor shouted and cannonballed into the water. Sam smiled. This had been one of his favorite spots, out on the pool deck, which always smelled like the lavender that grew in the bed by the fence, where the boards always held the warmth of the day's sun. At night, the underwater lights would cast a cool, eerie glow. The crickets would chirp, and the frogs would croak, and the spill of brilliant stars would shine in the sky. Ronnie and Sarah went upstairs, talking in low voices. Lord Farquaad established himself under a lounge chair, tucking his legs underneath him, resting his snout on the still warm deck, and looking for all the world like a furred baked potato. Sam watched his stepson and the time. 9:15, he called.
5 more minutes, please.
Okay, said Sam, and thought of his father, who'd always been the nighttime lifeguard.
Ronnie liked to go to bed early, tucked under the covers with a book. But Sam had liked to stay up late, and his dad would indulge him, sipping his after-dinner coffee by the pool, sometimes tossing weighted rings that Sam would dive for.
5 minutes are up.
Connor groaned but paddled to the edge of the pool, where Sam stood waiting with a towel.
"Come, let me bundle you," he said.
The same words he used after every bath at home, the ones his father had used with him. When Connor was wrapped head to toe like a boy-sized burrito, Sam scooped him into his arms and carried him downstairs. He gave him his Spider-Man pajamas and watched as he brushed his teeth.
"This is a good place," Connor said.
"And you haven't even seen the beach yet."
"Can we go now?" asked Connor. "Just for a minute, just to look."
"We'll go tomorrow," Sam patted Connor's hand. "Don't worry, we have lots of time."
Thursday.
The next morning, Sam left Connor sleeping and went quietly to the kitchen. He poured himself a cup of coffee, slipped through the sliding doors down the stairs, and walked along the beach, thinking, and trying not to think, about what he might do that night. Connor was still asleep when he got back. He showered and went back upstairs. His mother and sister were out by the pool deck, in the shade of an umbrella, sitting at a table set next to the hydrangeas, which were in glorious bloom, boughs drooping with
big, showy blooms in blue and pink and purple. Ronnie and Sarah turned identical gazes on Sam as he approached. "Where's Connor?" asked his mother. She was wearing one of her typical summer outfits, cropped linen pants and a long-sleeved T-shirt, both of which seemed too big for her. Her hands were veined, age-spotted and thin-skinned, the hands of a grandmother, not a mom. Although, Sam supposed, she was a grandmother now, the same way he was middle-aged. Still sleeping. "Where's Eli?" he asked his sister. His mother and sister exchanged a look. "We decided to take two cars," Sarah said. "He and Ari and the boys are on their way up now." Sam pulled his chair closer to his sister. "What's going on?"
"Nothing," Sarah answered too quickly.
She wore a white sundress, damp at the back and the shoulders from her shower-wet hair. Her feet were bare, toes freshly painted, and she seemed fidgety as she spun with one hand her coffee cup on the table. Her other hand, Sam noticed, rested on her pocket, through which he could see the outline of her phone. Maybe she was worried about Eli and the boys, he thought, or expecting a text from the car.
"When will they be here?" Ronnie asked.
"No idea," said Sarah. "All I know is that Eli's doing all the driving because Ari's license is currently suspended," she sighed. "Also, there's a bench warrant for him in Connecticut."
"Why?" Sam asked.
"I don't want to know," Sarah shook her head.
"I think your assignment, should you choose to accept it, will be to keep Ari away from the pot dispensaries."
"They have those here?" Sam asked.
"Oh, sure," said Ronnie. "There's one in Wellfleet called the Piping Plover. I liked the name so much I went in to compliment them, and they gave me a sample."
"Jesus, Ma," said Sam.
"Well, I didn't take it," Ronnie said primly.
"Throw it away," said Sarah. "The absolute last thing I need is Ari getting high."
She sighed and wrapped both hands around her mug.
"How are you doing?" Ronnie asked. "Has planning this been stressful?"
Sarah shook her head. "It's not that, it's..." She shook her head again.
Sam watched his sister carefully, wondering if she'd tell Ronnie what was troubling her. Finally, Sarah just said, "Eli's been a little moody."
Good job, Sam thought, feeling glad that his sister had broached the topic and relieved that the focus was off him.
"Maybe it's the wedding," Ronnie suggested. "His little girl is getting married. It's a big thing for a father."
"I don't know," Sarah's voice was low. "God knows I'd never say this to Ruby, but I think this wedding is a mistake. She hasn't known Gabe that long, and she's so young."
"So maybe that's it," Ronnie said.
"I don't know," Sarah said.
She drew a shaky breath.
"I'd assume that he was having an affair, except I don't know when he'd have time. He's under my feet every minute of the day," she shuddered. "And he's got those plantar fasciitis flip-flops," Sarah pointed at her mother. "I blame you for those, by the way."
Ronnie looked bewildered.
"How are his flip-flops my fault?"
"Because your friend was the one who told him how great they were."
"Ah," said Ronnie, "a thousand pardons."
She reached across the table and patted Sarah's forearm.
"I don't know what's going on with him, but Eli loves you."
In a leaden voice, Sarah said, "Sometimes people change." It struck Sam that he wouldn't get a more perfect segue or a better moment for his big reveal. You know how you think you can know someone and then they surprise you? You know how you think you know yourself? Well, guess what? I just figured out. He opened his mouth, unsure of how to start, which of course was the moment that Eli's car came crunching up the driveway. As soon as the car stopped, both back doors popped open and Dexter and Miles raced out of the car. Ari ambled out after them, wearing rumpled khaki cargo shorts and a T-shirt from a half marathon that Sam was almost positive that Eli, not Ari, had run.
"Hello, hello," Ari called, giving a genial wave, as Eli started to remove what looked like a dozen bags and suitcases from the trunk.
Connor, still in his Spider-Man pajamas, hurried out of the house to greet his cousins.
You guys, guess what? There's a beach here and a pool and a shower, and the shower is outside.
We know, said Dexter, who was trying to run and talk and take off his shoes at the same time. Eli came thumping up the steps with a tote bag in one hand and a canister of sunscreen in the other, calling, Children, do not even think about going in the water until you bring your things inside. Sarah almost jumped out of her chair. I should go get some wine for dinner, she said. Do we need anything else from the package store or Stop and Shop? Toilet paper, Ronnie said. She reached for Sarah's hand. But hang on, okay? I want to talk to you two about something. Sam and Sarah exchanged a worried look. Nothing bad, Ronnie said quickly as Sarah took her seat. Just now that you're both here in person, I figured it was a good time. Ronnie smoothed her fingertips over her eyebrows. I spoke to Paul Norman a few weeks ago. We agreed that it's the right time to put the house on the market. Before either of them could reply, Ronnie continued, I'd planned to leave you both the house in my will. I hoped you'd want to come here with your own kids so they could spend their summers together. She smiled sadly. But I think that was my vision of summer, not yours. She touched her eyebrows again. I was going to tell you after the wedding, only there's a couple who want to see the house on Monday, after the wedding. They're only up here until the end of next week, and Paul thinks that they're serious buyers, so... She clasped her hands at her chest, sighing. Sam tried to hide his shock, realizing that he couldn't imagine his mother living anywhere but here. He didn't spend much time at the Cape House, but he felt comforted knowing it was there, that he had a home, a place where they would have to take him in. He murmured something about how much he'd loved it here as a kid, how he wished he lived closer, how he and Connor would be here all the time if he did. Where will you go? Sarah asked her mother. Ronnie shrugged. I've got time to figure that out. His sister's expression was rueful and chagrined. I know, she said. I know we should have spent more time here. I know Dex and Miles are overscheduled. I know I'm turning into that mom. I should just give them time to hang out on the beach and collect seashells instead of taking them from cello to Hebrew school to Krav Maga. She buried her face in her hands and shook her head. I know. Ronnie put her hand on Sarah's shoulder. Honey, I promise I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. You're a wonderful mother. Sarah continued as if her mother hadn't spoken. But every parent I know is like that. You have to give your kid every possible opportunity, and if you don't, you're failing them. You can't not try. It's okay, Ronnie said firmly. Really, it's okay. I understand. I'm just so glad everyone's here, together, and I... She looked like she wanted to say more as Dexter and Miles and Connor, appropriately swimsuited and sunscreened, came thundering across the deck. Ronnie got to her feet. Wait, stop. I haven't seen you creatures in one entire year. How about a hug for Softa? Miles and Dexter ran to hug her, and over the din of the dog barking and Ronnie exclaiming how much the boys had grown, Sam almost didn't hear his sister when she said, I am a terrible human being. Before Sam could wonder at that or come up with an answer, Sarah was on her way down to the driveway. Let me get the lobsters in the fridge, she said. Then I'll head out. Sam, can you watch the kids? Sam said that he could. When Sarah had gone down to the driveway and Ronnie was up in the kitchen, he walked to the edge of the deck and studied his brother-in-law, watching as one story below him, Eli pulled grocery bags and tote bags and a set of golf clubs from the trunk. His brother-in-law looked the way he always did, maybe a little bit thinner. His hair was neatly trimmed, his clothes clean and relatively unwrinkled. His wedding band winked in the sunshine. He seemed fine. But of course, who knew better than Sam that you could keep a secret, one that completely altered your sense of yourself and the world, and not have any of it show, not even to the people who knew you best? After lunch and an hour spent unpacking, Sam and Sarah took all three boys down to the beach. "So," Sam said, when the boys were taking turns pushing each other around on the paddleboard, "enjoying the guilt trip?" Sarah shook her head. She'd pulled her hair back in a ponytail. It made her look young, even though she'd traded her bikinis for a conservative swimsuit with a skirted bottom, the kind of thing their mother had once worn. "She's right, though. I bet the boys would be happier here, doing nothing, than they are in Brooklyn doing everything." She wrapped her arms around herself and stared up at a parasailer gliding over the bay. "I know I'd be happier if I were here." "You know, I can work from anywhere," Sam said. "If you ever did decide to try a whole summer here, Connor and I could come for a while. We could ask Mom to hold off for a year or two. I bet she'd do it." "Maybe," said Sarah. She looked sad and remote. "I don't know." She slid the elastic off her ponytail, staring down at the water. "It feels like everything's changing, you know? Everything, all at once." It was another near-perfect opening, but Sarah already looked so glum. Sam was reluctant to drop another bomb. "Ah!" yelled Connor, running backward through the knee-deep water as fast as he could. "There's a crab! A giant, big one!" "Did it pinch you?" asked Sam. "No, but I could see it!" Sam waded into the clear shallows, where he saw a large crab waving both of its claws in the air as it attempted to scuttle away. "It's more afraid of you than you are of it," Sam reassured his stepson. Together they watched as the crab skittered sideways and buried itself in the sand. "I like how they do that," said Connor. Sam put his hand on the boy's shoulder. "Stick with me, kid," he said. "Tomorrow, we'll go out at low tide, and I'll teach you how to find clams with your feet." After an hour, Connor's nose and cheeks were looking pink. Sam herded the boys up the beach stairs and into the outdoor shower to rinse off. When the kids went back to the pool, Sam took his own shower, changed into khaki shorts and a polo shirt, and went up to the kitchen. He helped his mother pick the meat out of the lobsters, while Ruby, her curls held back by a red bandana, sliced avocado, tiny heirloom tomatoes, crispy bacon, and hard-boiled eggs. Lobster Cobb salad was Ronnie's signature summer dish, and she served it with ears of corn on the cob and homemade garlic bread. It was their usual welcome to the Cape meal, and the taste of it had always signaled the beginning of summer to Sam. The boys shucked the corn and set the table. Ruby whisked the dressing. Just before sunset, they all took their seats at the long wooden table that stretched between the kitchen counter and the living room's couches. Ronnie and Sarah wore sundresses, and the boys were in t-shirts and shorts, with their faces flushed from the sun. Everyone's feet were bare, and everyone looked relaxed and happy as Eli passed a bottle of white wine around the table, and the boys pleaded to be allowed to drink soda instead of water. "It's a special occasion," said Dexter. Ronnie raised the blinds for the traditional exclaiming over the sunset. Once the sun had dipped below the horizon and the ritual was complete, the platters were passed the length of the table and everyone began to eat. Sam kept his eyes on Eli during the meal, watching as his brother-in-law picked at his food and ignored his daughter's teasing remarks. Miles had to ask him twice to pass the water pitcher, and when Veronica asked if he'd prepared a toast, he'd looked like a kid who hadn't done the reading and who'd just learned there'd be a pop quiz.
"I'm working on it," he muttered.
"Don't worry," said Ari. "Eli's old faithful. He's never let anyone down." Sam was almost positive he saw Eli glare at his brother and Ari smirk in return as his mom asked, "Sam, what's new with you?"
"Oh, the usual," he said. "Nothing to report."
Ronnie narrowed her eyes and looked him over before giving a shrug so small that everyone else at the table probably missed it. Sam didn't miss it. His mother, he realized, had figured out that something was going on.
He wondered if she had any idea what that something was.
Ronnie looked at Sam, then at Sarah, then at Eli before lifting her wine glass.
"To family," she said. "I'm so glad for Ruby and so glad to have all of you here."
"To family," the boys repeated in a noisy chorus and knocked their plastic cups together.
"To family," said Ruby, and clinked her glass against Ronnie's.
Sam looked at his step-niece, remembering her sitting at this very same table when she'd been holding a plastic cup instead of a wine glass. Sunrise, sunset, he thought. There was a lump in his throat, and his eyes felt hot.
"To family," said Ari.
"Family," Eli said very softly.
"Family," said Sarah, giving Eli a look that was both pointed and frightened.
"To family," said Sam, and glanced discreetly at the time, thinking that in only a few hours he'd slip away from all this and into the gaudy, spangled spectacle that was Provincetown after dark. Sarah. From the moment she'd arrived on the Cape, Sarah had tried to keep busy. If she was constantly in motion, occupied with important wedding-related tasks, her mom couldn't engage her in the conversation she was dreading. "How's that new studio working out? How are things with Eli? And by the way, how's your marriage these days?" She'd unpacked all her clothes, hanging the light blue linen dress she'd bought for the wedding only after making sure she'd removed all the price tags. She'd cut off the conversation on the pool deck with her brother and her mom as quickly as she could, feeling almost weak with relief at the sound of Eli's arrival. Maybe her mom thought that she wanted to avoid Eli, or maybe she thought Sarah just needed some time to take in the news that the house was going on the market. Ronnie could think whatever she wanted, as long as she wasn't there, asking Sarah questions that Sarah didn't want to answer. So she'd fled. She'd gone to the liquor store for wine and champagne, and then on to the grocery store for toilet paper, for fruit and cheese and crackers. She lingered in the aisles, inspecting poison ivy remedies and frozen dinners, staring at Owen's texts. "I'm here waiting. Let me know if you've got any time." He'd sent a picture. A thirst trap, Sarah was pretty sure the kids would call it. A shot of his legs in board shorts as he sat on a towel in front of the sun-dappled pond. Part of her thought, "I can't." Another part thought, "I could." She could make up some excuse, invent some errand, even simply tell the truth. "I'm going to the pond for a swim." The boys would be happy to stay home with Sam and with Connor, and with Ari doing his fun uncle shtick. No one would miss her. Eli certainly wouldn't. She'd typed and erased a half dozen responses to Owen before finally deciding to go home, to be a good daughter, a good stepmother, a good wife, at least for now. Back at the house, Sarah had set the table and washed the dishes and swept the kitchen floor. After the lobster Cobb salad had been decimated, she'd volunteered to put the boys to bed. But when Sam said, "I got it," she had gone out on the deck to listen to the ocean and let the evening breeze cool her cheeks. Less than a minute later, she heard the door slide open behind her and knew that the moment of reckoning had arrived. "How are you?" Ronnie asked and touched Sarah's arm. "Everything okay?" Sarah kept her face expressionless, cursing her mother's empathy. "I'm fine." Ronnie leaned on the railing, mimicking Sarah's posture. "This is all making me think about your wedding," Ronnie said. "I couldn't believe you were old enough to be someone's wife. I could still remember you and Sam playing on the beach. Remember how you used to tell Sam he had to pay you a toll to get up the stairs?" Sarah nodded. "The toll is 3 hermit crabs," she'd announce imperiously. "Or you have to pay me 6 slipper shells." And poor Sam would grab a bucket and run back down the stairs to collect them. "Your father was a wreck," her mother said. "He was so worried he'd start crying under the huppah and that he wouldn't be able to stop.
How's Eli doing?
Eli's fine. Sarah heard how angry she sounded. In truth, she had no idea how Eli was handling things because Eli had stopped talking to her. And ever since her night with Owen, she hadn't been able to bring herself to care. She ordered the groceries, she went to work, she picked up Ruby's wedding gown, and made calls to triple-check on the flowers, and all the while her body was tingling and her mind was preoccupied, full of blissful thoughts of Owen Lassiter. She barely ate, hardly slept. She felt like a teenage girl with a crush, because of course she'd been a teenage girl with a crush the first time she'd fallen for Owen. "And you're okay?" her mother asked. "I'm fine," Sarah said, before deciding to give her mother a small piece of truth. "Honestly, I guess I was a little hurt that Ruby told you about the wedding before she told me. I know you guys are close, and I think it's great, but..." She shook her head, ashamed at herself for being petty, for finding her mother's happiness a threat to her own. "I'm probably being stupid."
"No, I get it," said her mom.
"I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings. I wish I'd told you as soon as she told me." Sarah looked at her mother, surprised by how shrunken she seemed, how fine her hair looked. She'd only seen her mother for a week the previous summer, and only after they'd all been tested for COVID and quarantined 2 weeks in advance, and then another 2 weeks after they'd come home. In less than a year, Ronnie had lost weight, and Sarah thought height, too. There were new pigmented spots on her face, new bags beneath her eyes, and Sarah could see clearly the shape of her skull through her hair. "Ruby loves this place as much as I do."
"As much as you and Sam didn't," Sarah heard her mother say.
"When she called and said she wanted to be married here, I was just so happy. We'd have a chance to all be together."
"It shouldn't have bothered me," Sarah said. "And for the record, I always loved it here, too. It's just, with the boys and everything they've got going on, it's complicated."
As she spoke, she discovered that she was angry at her mother, angry in a way she'd never let herself acknowledge. Ronnie had pulled it off perfectly. She'd had a life as an artist, and had then been able to comfortably, happily set that life aside. Ronnie had never strayed during her happy marriage, because Sarah's father had never given her a reason to look elsewhere for love and affection. She'd given her children idyllic summers in this unspoiled, perfect place. Even in her anger, Sarah wished that, in spite of the complications, she'd let the boys spend more time here during the summers, that she'd allowed them to take a few months off from their music lessons and language classes and spend lazy, unstructured hours reading or swimming or exploring or daydreaming as she and Sam had done. But the truth, one that she'd barely acknowledged even in the privacy of her own brain, was that she hadn't loved it here. Not after what had happened with Owen. For years, every place she saw, every food she tasted, the sight of the Wellfleet drive-in's marquee or a whiff of fried onion rings as she drove past Arnold's brought back a memory of something they'd done together and made her ache. Everything felt tainted. Everything had hurt. She'd been glad when she'd fallen in love with Eli, glad of the path that life with him offered. Glad, too, that the path had led her away from Cape Cod, from Ronnie's scrutiny, and maybe even her disappointment that Sarah hadn't stuck with her music. Eli's parents had a place at the Jersey Shore, a 2.5-hour drive instead of a 6-hour one. It gave her an easy excuse not to make the trip to Massachusetts. "You don't need to apologize, I understand," her mother said. But Sarah felt like she had to keep trying to explain, maybe to Ronnie, maybe to herself. "I've got friends who rent places in the Hamptons or who stay with their parents out there, and that's doable, but getting up here..."
"I know it's a haul," said her mother. She smiled a little.
"Did I ever tell you I was in the Hamptons once? For a film festival when The Summer Sisters came out."
Sarah, who'd only ever heard a handful of her mother's stories about her writing life, shook her head.
"I don't know what it's like there these days, but
When I went there, I'd never seen such awful traffic leaving the city in my life, Ronnie said. And then at the screening, I remember feeling like I was twice the size of every other woman there. She laughed a little. Twice as big and maybe 1/16th as fashionable. And I'd never been skinnier or better dressed. She shook her head, her expression regretful. I wasn't in a hurry to go back. The outer cape is much more my speed. Is it hard being here, Sarah asked, without Dad? Ronnie hesitated. Her shoulders slumped, and Sarah felt guilty for bringing up something that was clearly still painful. I miss him. Sometimes I still feel like he's just away, you know? Not dead, just at the hardware store buying light bulbs, or at the library getting a new book. She sighed and added, but this was always much more of my place than his. Really? Sarah knew, of course, that her mom had spent every day here in the summertime, while her father had only come for 2 weeks vacation and then on weekends. But she had memories of her dad and Truro, showing her and Sam how to build bonfires, wading with them out to the sandbar to kick a soccer ball around during low tide, clamming in the summer and oystering in the fall, teaching Sam and Sarah how to drive when they were 13 in the Cornhill Beach parking lot at twilight, after making them swear not to tell Mom. Oh, Lord, Ronnie said, laughing a little. You don't remember? Your dad got sunburned if he even thought about the sun. He wasn't much of a swimmer. He didn't like seafood. He got seasick on any kind of boats, including kayaks and canoes. Sarah was bewildered. He went fishing with us. She could picture her dad in his Red Sox ball cap and aviator sunglasses, with a stripe of zinc on his nose. They'd catch striped bass and eat fillets for weeks, cooked in the oven with mustard and breadcrumbs or grilled. He'd take Dramamine. And he was always on the beach. In a hat, Ronnie said, and a long-sleeve shirt and a face full of SPF 50. Ronnie was staring at her daughter, eyebrows drawn. You really don't remember? Sarah shook her head, imagining she could feel the ground wobble under her feet. If he hated it here, he did a good job of hiding it. He didn't hate it. Ronnie's voice was patient. But I was the one who loved the Cape, and he was willing to indulge me. She curled her fingers around the railing, her gold wedding band catching the light of the moon. Maybe because it was my money that paid for the place. Sarah felt like she'd been walking briskly down a flight of stairs where one of the steps was missing. Like she'd set all her weight down on empty air instead of a solid surface. Her mother had never spoken to her about her marriage, and they'd never talked at all about money. Was that an issue for him? Sarah asked, choosing her words carefully. That you bought the house? Sarah expected immediate refusal. Ronnie, instead, gave her a sigh. He was proud of me, she said. He was proud that I was successful, but... No, I don't think it was easy for him, the years I was making more money. Is that why you stopped writing? I stopped publishing, Ronnie said. Again, Sarah wondered at the distinction, as her mother said, and that wasn't the reason, but I think that maybe it did end up making things easier. So Dad was jealous of you? Sarah's voice was flat. She could feel anger building, a tension in her chest. Lee Weinberg was dead. Couldn't Sarah be allowed to remember him as a good man, the good father she'd loved? Aren't you ever jealous of Eli? Asked her mother. Sarah began to shake her head when a memory struck. A morning in the winter when Dexter was 1.5 and Miles was a newborn. Eli had taken 2 weeks off for paternity leave, but as of that morning, the leave was over. He'd gotten dressed in his suit and tie and was heading off to work, leaving Sarah at home. She'd had a nanny who came 5 days a week and a cleaning woman who came twice a week, and Ronnie would be there that weekend. Sarah knew she was one of the lucky ones. She was ashamed of feeling so overwhelmed, and still, she could recall being angry at Eli,
who'd be able to spend his day having conversations with other adults, who wouldn't have his bathroom breaks interrupted, who'd be able to sit down for a meal with a napkin on his lap and both hands at his disposal, who could go for as long as he wanted without anyone pawing at him or sucking at him with grasping hands and sticky fingers and surprisingly strong toothless mouths. Marriages can survive a little resentment, Ronnie said. Marriages can survive a lot of things. What's the worst thing your marriage survived? Sarah thought. She'd never ask her mom that kind of question, but in the darkness with the wind erasing their words almost as soon as they were spoken, she felt as if she could. Anything you want to tell me, Mom? She kept her tone light, but her mother surprised her again. Oh, said Ronnie, with her lips curved into that thin, ironic smile. Well, I guess the statute of limitations has expired. Sarah held her breath, fighting down an urge to slap her hands over her ears as her mother said, Once, a long time ago, there was another man. Sarah heard herself gasping, her mother's words lighting her up with shamed recognition. No. Yes, said her mother, in New York. And what happened? Part of her wanted her mother to have virtuously walked away from the other man. The idea of her beloved father being betrayed made Sarah furious. But part of her wanted it to be more complicated, because that, she acknowledged, would assuage her own guilt. I gave him up, her mother said. Or really, he ended things. And I decided I wanted to be with your father. I realized, in the end, it wasn't even about the other man. It was about how he made me feel, who I was when I was with him. I decided that I didn't want to be that version of myself. She smiled thinly. I didn't like her very much. Sarah swallowed hard. Did Dad know? Ronnie shook her head. I never told him. And this other man? Ronnie raised her hands, palms open to the sky. We didn't keep in touch, and I never went looking for him, even after Google. But this other man, he was in New York? He was. He was one of the people I met when my first book came out. And is that why you stopped? Sarah almost said, writing, and at the last minute corrected herself. Publishing? That's one of the reasons, said her mom. She tilted her head. Part of it was about punishing myself for what I'd done, and avoiding temptation, of course. I knew that I wanted to be married to your dad. I wanted to be a mother. She gave Sarah a wry look, even though you don't remember it that way. Sarah bit her lip, flushed at the memory of how she'd complained about the babysitters and the mother's helpers who'd cared for her and Sam while her mom worked. She pulled off the elastic band securing her hair in a ponytail and wrapped it around her index finger, so tightly that the flesh at her fingertip turned red, then white. Do you remember Owen? She asked. Owen Lassiter, Ronnie said in a dry voice. How could I forget? Her mother, of course, knew Sarah's whole history with Owen. How desperately, foolishly in love she'd been. How they'd planned to stay together in college, and how he'd dumped her. Sarah waited, braced for questions or sardonic commentary on the pond people. But again, her mother surprised her. Poor Owen. Poor Owen? Sarah's voice rang out, loud and indignant. He dumped me, remember? Ronnie drummed her fingers on the railing. You probably don't remember this, but for a while, twice a year, the local paper would print a list of who was in arrears for their property taxes and how much they owed. So you knew? Sarah tried to keep her voice expressionless, but she still sounded like she'd been punched, her voice breathless and faint. You knew his family was broke. Ronnie nodded, looking a little surprised. I did. But how did you know? Sarah felt her face get hot. She curled her bare toes into the deck. I ran into Owen recently in the city, she said. We had coffee. He told me he hadn't been honest with me about, well, a lot of things.
About how he wasn't at Duke?
Sarah stared at her mother once again, shocked into silence. Ronnie gave a small, shame-faced shrug.
One of my former colleagues was in their English department. I asked her to keep an eye out for him. She was the one who told me he wasn't enrolled.
And when were you going to tell me? Sarah asked.
I wasn't, said Ronnie. It was his story to tell. I didn't see the point.
You didn't think I deserved to know he was lying to me?
I figured he had his reasons. I didn't want you thinking I was spying on your boyfriend.
Ronnie's voice was maddeningly serene. Sarah scraped her hair back into its ponytail, twisting the elastic punishingly tight. She found herself wishing, pointlessly, that her mother had told her more, told her which path to follow when she couldn't decide whether or not to pursue her music, told her the truth about Owen, told her that her own marriage hadn't always been perfect, hadn't always been easy. But that would have made Veronica Levy a different kind of person, certainly a different kind of mother, a mother who hovered and directed and micromanaged, a mother who cleared every obstacle out of the way before her child could come close to stumbling, who'd never let her kid struggle to figure it out for herself, a mother very much like Sarah herself. Through her guilt and confusion, it was hard to form a question, hard to speak. Why'd you feel sorry for Owen? Sarah made herself ask.
Her mother's expression was hard to read in the dark. I remember the way he looked every time he was over, like he'd never seen people eating at a table or speaking kindly to each other. I know he hurt you, in the end, but he always made me feel sad. Sad and lucky, her voice cracked, and Sarah looked and saw a tear sliding down her mother's seamed face.
Mom, what's wrong?
Ronnie wiped her face, shaking her head.
Oh, it's just that weddings make me cry, and I love having all of you here. I just wish...
Her voice cracked again, and she pressed her hands to her eyes.
What? Sarah asked.
You wish what?
Nothing. Ronnie shook her head and straightened her spine. I just want you to know that, as long as I'm here, you and the boys are welcome for as long as you want to be here.
And Sarah, still stunned by her mother's revelation, and relieved that Owen was no longer the topic of discussion, that she hadn't blurted out a confession she wouldn't be able to unspeak, found herself promising that she'd look at their schedule and see if she and the boys could stay for another few weeks once the wedding was through.
Ruby.
After eating enough lobster Cobb salad to prevent comment, after helping Sarah clean the kitchen and her brothers find their pajamas, Ruby went to the guest house and pulled the door shut behind her. Her wedding gown, still sheathed in its clear plastic garment bag, was hanging on the back of the bathroom door. Her white satin shoes with their sparkly blue crystal buckles were underneath it. In the twilight, in the breeze, the shoes and the dress looked like a ghost bride, an invisible woman facing her, taunting her. Ruby's phone hummed. She pulled it out to see Gabe's text. Got my mom and Aunt Amanda. Hitting the road. See you soon. She pocketed the phone without responding and turned away from the wedding dress. A vase of pink peonies stood on the kitchenette counter, and two extension cords were coiled neatly beside it. A makeup mirror lined with lights was set up on a vanity in the bedroom. And in the bathroom, Sarah had found two plush terry cloth bathrobes, one monogrammed bride, the other monogrammed groom. I'm so happy for you both, read the card in the bride robe's pocket. Love you always, Softa. Ruby knew if she looked in the miniature refrigerator, she'd find flavored seltzer, Greek yogurt, and Rainier cherries, because her grandmother knew all her favorites. She knew, too, that the bed had been made with her favorite brushed flannel sheets, and that Softa had purchased the hazelnut-flavored coffee that she liked. Tomorrow morning, the florist was coming to do a walkthrough. Tomorrow afternoon, the musicians would stop by to drop off their amps.
The caterers had already left boxes of plates and crystal wine glasses in the garage. The cleaning crew had already ensured that the house was spotless. Every possible hitch that Ruby had imagined, "Are you crazy? You can't get a wedding dress in just 4 months," or "Sorry, all of our musicians are booked," or "I've called every single caterer and no one's free on such short notice," had either failed to materialize or just been artfully, charmingly negotiated by her stepmother and her softa so that Ruby could have what she wanted, or what Ruby had thought she'd wanted. "I can't do this," Ruby Faye Danhauser thought to herself. She said it out loud to the empty guest house. "I can't do this." And with the word still ringing in the air, she sat down hard on the edge of the bed. The windows were open. Ruby could smell and hear the ocean along with bonfire smoke and the sound of music, conversation, laughter when the wind gusted. Someone was having a party down on the beach. She pictured people her age laughing and happy. Maybe they were passing around a bottle or a joint. Maybe they were flirting. Maybe there were old couples breaking apart, new relationships sparking to life. All her happy peers who hadn't gotten themselves stuck. Young men and women who hadn't played Houdini, wrapping themselves in chains and locking themselves into a box with no hope of escape. She could hear the murmur of female voices from the deck. Her stepmother and her softa, probably talking about last-minute details, making sure everything was perfect. Her wedding dress rippled in the breeze. Ruby, for sure, her dad used to call her. Her first-grade teacher had written, "Ruby is an extremely focused and hard-working student. Her drive and determination will surely help her succeed," on her report card. And what kind of kid gets described as driven and determined when she's 6 years old? Ruby buried her face in her hands and groaned. All of her teachers had said versions of the same thing. No matter what she'd tried, whether she had any talent or not, school and soccer, drums and Hebrew lessons, it was always the same thing. Ruby is focused. Ruby is driven, determined, single-minded. A little scary, that last from her drumming teacher, an amiable stoner named Scoot. Ruby had overheard him say that to her dad once, that he'd never seen a kid practice as hard as Ruby, that he'd never seen anyone so set on mastering a skill. "She just keeps bashing away at it," Scoot had said, shaking his head in what could have been admiration or could have been fear. "That's my Ruby," her dad had said fondly. "She knows what she wants, and she works for it." When she'd seen her first Broadway show, she'd sat leaning forward, entranced, as the story unfolded. It had been Phantom of the Opera, super cheesy, super unfashionable, super easy for her eventual Tisch classmates to trash. But when the very first organ chords came thundering through the theater, Ruby had felt electrified. Her skin had prickled with goosebumps. She'd almost been afraid to draw a breath. In the second act, the Phantom was singing in front of a stand holding sheet music, with a candelabra flaming beside him, and one of the pages had caught on fire. Ruby wasn't sure if it was part of the show or not, and as she watched, as the Phantom kept singing, a man dressed all in black, wearing a headset, hurried onto the stage. He deftly snatched the burning page, given it a brief pump of something chemical from a bottle in his pocket, and ran into the wings. It had all happened so smoothly and so fast that Ruby wasn't completely sure that she'd seen it. After she'd asked her father about it, and her father, it emerged, hadn't even noticed. "Oh, one of the stagehands, probably," he'd said after Ruby recounted what had happened, how disaster had been so narrowly and gracefully averted, and had asked about the man who'd come running. "It takes a whole lot of people to make a show like that happen, and we never even see most of them." Ruby had been enthralled at the idea of backstage, the notion that there were people the audience would never see, people who didn't sing or dance or act who were still part of the performance, invisible but indispensable as they helped the story unfold.
As soon as she'd figured out that those were jobs and that when she grew up, she could have one, that was what she'd wanted to do with her life, and she'd never wavered. She'd never wavered about anything big until this. Until now. With her face buried in her hands, her eyes squeezed shut, Ruby felt like she was pretending to be a little kid again, a kid who thought that if she couldn't see anyone, no one could see her. She whispered again, "I can't do this," and started to cry, a great scalding flood of tears that made her throat ache. Still crying, Ruby stood up, on legs that felt as heavy and immobile as the pillars of Stonehenge, and found a pen and a pad in the kitchen. "Gabe, I'm sorry, I can't do this. I thought I was ready, but I'm not. It isn't you, I promise," she wrote, knowing that she couldn't begin to encompass all the ways that Gabe was wonderful, how he was sweet and considerate, how he'd filled their apartment with plants and made them grow and bloom, how he'd made her feel cherished and cared for. Somehow still, that wasn't enough. Or it was enough, only it wasn't what she wanted right now. For one of the few times in her life, Ruby was unsure, and that sensation of not knowing her own mind was terrifying. "I'm so sorry, I never meant to hurt you." More inadequate words, lying there limply on the page. But what else was there? She signed her name, and then, because she was a gutless coward, she folded the piece of paper, wrote Gabe's name on top, left it on his pillow, and walked out the door. She planned to take a bicycle out of the garage, to ride it, by the light of the moon, out to Route 6, and make her mind up there. There were buses that ran from Truro to Hyannis. There were planes that went from Hyannis to New York City, and from New York she would return home to Brooklyn, or go anywhere in the world. She hurried down the steps and over to the side door that led to the garage. But when she pulled the handle, the door refused to budge. Frowning, Ruby worked the doorknob back and forth. She could feel it turn, but when she pulled again, the door was unyielding. "Shit," she muttered. "Ha," thought the house. Ruby walked through the courtyard to try to open the big garage doors and found that all of them were locked, or maybe they'd only respond to electronic clickers and not hands. Fine, thought Ruby. If she couldn't ride, then she'd walk. She took off, head down, moving quickly down the steps, up the driveway, and out to the road that led to the beach, and Route 6. Provincetown was one way, Boston was the other. Her heart was beating too hard, her eyes stinging. She didn't see the car as it slowed and pulled up beside her. Didn't notice the window roll down or feel the driver's gaze upon her. Then she heard a woman's voice call her name. Ruby turned. And there, as if she had conjured her out of the ether with the force of her own longing, was her mother, the mother she hadn't seen since before COVID. Ruby wiped her eyes, then squinted to confirm that it was, indeed, Annette, sitting behind the wheel of a rental car, wearing a white peasant top with flowers embroidered on its bodice, and an incongruous straw sun hat on her head. "Ruby?" asked Annette. "Is everything okay?" Ruby armed tears off her face. "Oh, Mom," she said, and couldn't go on. Annette pulled onto the shoulder and put the car in park. She got out and wrapped her arms around her daughter, pulling her close. They stood together for a long moment, mother and daughter on the side of the road. When another car's headlights swept the pavement, Annette led Ruby around the back of her car and opened the passenger side door. "Hop in." Ruby looked at her mother wide-eyed, tears trembling on the tips of her eyelashes. "Where are we going?" "Wherever you need to be right now." Annette put the car in gear and pulled smoothly out onto the road. "We can go get fried seafood, or we can Thelma and Louise it." Ruby wiped her eyes. "I don't want to drive over a cliff." "So we'll drive to an airport," said her mother. "Or we'll just drive. Whatever you need. Just let me take care of you. Let me help."
Annette. Annette Morgan. Once, briefly, Annette Danhauser. Knew what the world thought of her. She had flouted a primal directive, broken a central rule. She had walked away from her child, not to mention a man who loved her, a man who'd loved them both. Annette had always understood the consequences of her choices. She'd known, when she left, that she would spend the rest of her life paying the price, and the price would be punishingly high. Do you have any children? New friends and lovers, well-meaning co-workers, strangers who'd struck up a conversation with her, all of them would ask in a dozen different languages, "Do you have kids?" Annette had tried at first to simply say, "No." She'd birthed a child, of course, but she'd never had one. And while that distinction might have been lost on most of the world, it was meaningful to Annette. Ruby had never truly felt like she belonged to Annette. Ruby belonged to her father, Eli, and to Eli's parents. Eventually, Ruby had belonged to Eli's new wife, and to Sarah and Eli's sons, to Sarah's parents, who served as honorary step-grandparents. Ruby belonged to the family that Eli and Sarah had built together. Ruby had a place in the world, and it was a good place. Things had worked out for the best. But you couldn't always say all of that, Annette had found. Not to well-meaning strangers or curious colleagues, or the person on the mat beside yours in a yoga class. At least, a woman couldn't. The world made space for men who left, who walked away from wives and children, sometimes more than once. Maybe the world had to make room for those men because there were so many of them. Men who put themselves or their careers or their dreams or their desire to sleep with other people ahead of their spouses and children. The world forgave them. It gave them second and third chances. Women were not offered any such grace. A divorced man who'd moved out of the family home to a different town or a different state or even a different country could still be regarded in some circles as a catch. A woman who did it was a monster. Annette thought sometimes that even women who hurt their children got more sympathy than ones who decided to leave them. People would murmur sympathetically about postpartum psychosis. Friends and neighbors would give interviews about how much that poor mother had loved her kids. "She must have snapped," a neighbor would say. "She just cracked," a friend would announce. A weeping husband would say, "This wasn't her. She would never, ever do a thing like this in her right mind." Annette wondered about that, about all those mothers snapping and cracking, bending and breaking. Sometimes she'd think that there had to be more women like her, that she couldn't be the only one. She looked for them, the women who, like her, had held their babies in their arms and looked down at those dear, tiny faces, the womb-crumpled ears and off-kilter noses, and felt nothing. No, worse than nothing, bone-deep terror, a certainty that they would make nothing but mistakes and cause nothing but pain, and an overwhelming desire to run. Other women who would sit at home with that new baby in their arms and watch the clock counting the hours until a boyfriend or husband or babysitter came to rescue them, because they could feel their very souls shriveling and dying as the minutes dragged by. Women who gagged at the smell of a dirty diaper, women who longed for sleep the way they desire the most sumptuous meal, the very best sex, women who always felt like imposters, women who never automatically looked up when a childish voice called, "Mom!" Surely Annette would tell herself there were more women like her out there. No matter how alone and isolated she felt, she couldn't possibly be the only one. Annette had always known that she could never be a mother. She had never lied. She told Eli all along that she never wanted to get married or become a mother or settle down in a suburb. And Eli, the duplicitous, self-centered creep, had sworn to her that he felt the same way. Eli had grown up in a suburb of Long Island,
with a dad who commuted to the city and a mom who stayed home and tended her children. Annette had grown up in a suburb of New Jersey, with a dad who commuted to the city and a mom with a part-time job at a boutique. Neither Annette nor Eli wanted that life for themselves. Together, they'd watched their classmates marching in lockstep from the altar to the delivery suite and then to the better suburbs of the tri-state area in that order. "Not for us," Annette would say. "Not for us," Eli would agree. Eventually, it emerged that when Eli said, "not for us," he'd really meant, "not right now." That when he'd said never, he'd meant, "I won't want any of that until I turn 30, at which point I will want all of it. Everything that you and I say we despise." Annette hadn't planned on telling Eli when she'd gotten pregnant. She was going to take care of it herself. They'd been in the States, which was lucky, subletting a studio in Brooklyn. Annette had been waitressing per usual at an Italian restaurant in Williamsburg, and Eli had found work with a master carpenter. He would come home fragrant from wood shavings, telling her about the Brazilian mahogany floor he'd installed at a gut renovation on Court Street, or the tiger maple escritoire he and Pete were refinishing. Eli's parents would take them out to dinner, which meant free food and nonstop interrogation. Stan and Judy would start out with subtle hints during the appetizer. "Haven't you gotten all this wanderlust out of your blood?" And move on to direct questions with the main course. "You're not going to do construction for the rest of your life, are you? If you apply to dental school now, you could start in September." By the time dessert and coffee arrived, Eli's mom would practically be in tears. "This is not what I wanted for my sons. First Ari, now you." And his dad would be tight-lipped and glaring. After those meals, Eli would be quiet and moody. And in the days that followed, Annette would catch him staring at some kid's braces or hear him sighing longingly at the sight of an overbite. Annette knew that a pregnancy would tip the precariously balanced scales. If Eli found out, she'd lose the life she wanted and end up stuck with the life that everyone wanted her to have. He'd notice if she took the necessary funds out of their joint checking account, but she had her tips, and she had friends, and they could loan her the money. Eli would never have to know. Except it turned out that Eli was paying attention to her cycles. He'd known that she'd missed her period. He'd dug the pregnancy test out of the kitchen trash can. On a Friday night, Annette came home from work to find him waving the urine-soaked wand at her, his attitude somewhere between exultant and furious. "When were you going to tell me?" he asked. "I wasn't," she answered. "You can't have an abortion," he said. "I can," she said. "It's already scheduled." Eli had looked shocked. Then he'd begged her not to do it. He'd yelled that it was his baby, too. Then he'd cried. Over the weekend, he'd painted her a picture of a life they could have, the two of them plus a baby, which, in his descriptions, sounded no different from an adorable doll, easily transported. No impediment to their travel, no trouble at all. They could buy a sailboat and travel around the world, dropping anchor any place Annette had ever dreamed of. They could raise chickens on a farm upstate, or build birdhouses in Montecito, or lead bike trips around Azure Blue Lake Atitlan in Guatemala. "Only please, please don't kill our baby." "It's not a baby," she'd said, irritated and nauseated and exhausted after an 8-hour shift on her feet. "Don't tell me she's just a clump of cells, because she isn't. She has her own DNA, her own fingerprints." Eli had started referring to the embryo as "she" just to be extra aggravating. "It's a parasite," Annette said. "It's alive, yes, it's its own thing, fine, but it can't live without me. She has her own heart, which is pumping my blood and which can't beat without me." They'd gone round and round, Eli insisting that what was inside her was a child, their child. Annette just as certain that what was inside of her was more like a possibility, a set of circumstances that might or might not come to pass. And who was he to even voice an opinion? None of this was happening inside his body. If you really believe that what's inside of me is an actual person, you should sit Shiva every time I get my period, because maybe there's a fertilized egg in there that didn't implant or didn't survive, and according to you, that's a person too, she said. For hours they'd fought, with Annette saying it was her body and her choice, and Eli saying that the baby was half his. Annette had shouted, Eli had pleaded. Finally, Annette had locked herself in the bedroom while Eli stood in the hallway, still making his case.